Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Matthew Gentry Show because from the University of Kentucky, professor in the Department of Molecular and Cellular Biochemistry, director of the UK Brain Metabolism Program, director of the Lafora Epilepsy Cure Initiative Center, we have Dr. Matthew Gentry. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks. Glad to be here today.
My co-medical host is here due to an error in scheduling.
You can't keep me away, Tony.
From the University of Kentucky, Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, Rick Phillips, to explain to you how you can access Health Matters on your computer.
You know, you can get the audio of the shows at WMKY.org. That's right, Morehead State Public Radio's website. There you just got to find Health Matters, get to their page, and you'll see a list of the most recent shows. There'll be a summary telling you kind of what's in there, and sometimes Tony gets that right and sometimes he doesn't. But either way, there is a link there to the audio so you can listen for yourself and see if he got it right. If you want to get to iTunes and do a podcast or just podcast with a regular podcasting service, the link's there. Again, I always say if you know what a podcast is, then you know what to do. After that, stop with the one-way communication. Get into the two-way communication. Interact with Health Matters. Jump over on Facebook. Do a search for HM Radio Show. There you'll find Health Matters in all its glory. You can put We put postings up there from things that go on the show. We put things that are relevant to the times. We always keep track of where Eric Kahn is. You just never know what you're going to see on the Health Matters website. Again, it's your chance to give us show topics, feedback, interact with the cast. We do actually get in and log in and check that. So it's not done through some kind of auto bot or person. So Tony actually gets in there and reads and responds. And I go in and make jokes. That's what I do. Again, you can find that at facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And our co-medical host, I should say, Shelley Irving, is on assignment in Isenville, as she has been.
Does she ever get assigned anywhere else?
Well, it's a breaking story. It's a big deal. You know, it's that sort of thing.
Could you please assign her somewhere else?
Our sponsor for today's show, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease is Lafora disease. It's a rare disease, but don't ignore a serious condition like Lafora. We've got our top eight fun facts. Not fun facts. I can't say fun facts. You know, sometimes you can make jokes, make light of things, but not this one.
So tone it down a little bit, you're telling me?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me just point out that our WKY station manager, program manager, John Lamagi and Rick are all taking bets about how many times I can say Department of Molecular and Cellular Biochemistry before I mess it up. So we've got our bets placed on that. And everybody's
you got your what placed on that?
I got our bets placed on that. See, I mean, it bleeds over into other aspects of the show. You see how you get one hard word, and then all of a sudden, nothing comes out right. Thanks for pointing that out to our audience, Rick. So, our top eight facts about Lafora disease. Number one, Lafora disease, it's an inherited, it's a severe form of progressive epilepsy or seizures. Most commonly begins with seizures in late childhood or adolescence. Kids start developing these seizures. Then there is a progressive problems, progressive damage to the brain, which leads to difficulty walking, muscle spasms, and difficulty thinking. Fact number two, Lafora fact number two, most cases caused by an autosomal recessive mutation in a couple of genes that code for some proteins that affect the way your body handles glucose and glycogen. I know that's complicated, but we'll explain it a little bit more in depth. The key thing is autosomal recessive. What that means is everybody's got two genes. You got one. If you have one that codes that is defective, then you're fine. If you have two that are defective, you're in trouble. And when you put two people, they marry and they make babies, and those babies, they may get each of those has an abnormal gene, then there's a 1 in 4 chance that a baby will get two abnormal genes and will have this disease. So the parents may not know they have it, or it may be running in the families, and they may be aware of it, but you're still rolling the dice essentially genetically when you have a baby if you're both carriers. Lafora fact number three, mutations in those genes interfere with the production of functional proteins, as we mentioned. That leads to the formation of Lafora bodies, and we'll talk more about that. Those are clumps of glycogen, and that appears to damage the nerves and lead to the problems. Lafora fact number four, affected people experience rapid cognitive deterioration beginning around the same times as seizures, and this disease, unfortunately, is often fatal within 10 years of onset. So we've got more facts, Lafora facts about Lafora disease coming up in our second fractional portion, but we, first of all, we want to talk a little bit with Matt about how he became interested in this disease and also about how he became a scientist in general. And Matt, he's been wonderful about this. He's actually provided an outline about how he really got into science. Matt, I don't want to steal your thunder. We'll begin, I guess, in southern Indiana and with your choice of colleges and so forth. And in the Syracuse Alumni Magazine back in 2013, you said you learned a life lesson. You said, explore your options and pay attention to what you do best. So can you pick up from there? What happened in college and how did you develop a career in science?
Yeah. So, Tony, I was at University of Evansville in southern Indiana and was there to be a physical therapist. I grew up in a small town of only about 2,000 folks, largely an industrial town, and my parents wanted me to go to college to learn a white-collar trade. And I thought that I wanted to be in the medical community, and so I started in physical therapy. And quickly realized that to be a physical therapist, you have to, one, be around patients, and two, be in a hospital. And there was a lot of bodily fluids and things that I wasn't comfortable with. And I ignored that for really the first 2 years of my undergraduate school. And some folks that were interviewing me to see if I was ready to advance to the next stage really keyed in on this and saw that I wasn't a great fit to be in the medical community. And I was denied access to this program to be a physical therapist. And after taking a little time off, I came back and then went in and started taking upper-level biochemistry courses, chemistry, biology, and everything just started to click and everything started to make sense. And I had realized at that point that I really needed to listen to that gut feeling, those instincts that you have about what you're good at, and run with those.
And this is a lesson, again, for our radio audience, especially you young people out there. I would consider Matt Gentry to be a Health Matters hottie. Would you, Rick?
Sure.
Yeah. A Health Matters hero of today's youth, Matt Gentry, because he provides a pathway for a person from a small town. You came from a small town in Indiana.
I did, yeah. Small town of 2,000 people.
Now, when was it in college that you experienced this rejection? This was not as a college graduate.
This was it was towards the end of my sophomore year, right before finals. I found out that I wasn't going to progress in the physical therapy program. A terrible lesson that I learned is don't skip your finals if you get bad news. I skipped my finals and went to a blues show in Memphis. And, you know, when I talk to students, what I tell them is that you can make, number one, don't make bad mistakes. But if you do make bad mistakes, you can recover from those. And so my GPA took a hit that semester. I was able to bring that back up, find what I love to do, and really focus on that passion of science and basic research.
I hope you hear the level of devastation. I've been talking with Matt for a while, and not the kind of guy that skips out on important things, but to go to Memphis to listen to the blues. I mean, it was boy, you were living the blues, I suspect.
It was a tough weekend, yeah.
Then coming back, you enrolled in these science courses. I suppose there was some splaining to do.
My parents weren't real thrilled. Yeah. You know, they made me take a semester off and sort of recalibrate what I wanted in life, prove to them that I was dedicated to doing this. And then once I got back in at University of Evansville, like I said, the science courses, they just made sense, and it wasn't work anymore. It was fun to study and do that work.
Now, in case you haven't figured it out, Matt is a pretty darn smart guy. So he comes back. He takes science courses at the University of Evansville. This is a liberal arts school, not known for scientific research, and parlays that into an admission into Syracuse for graduate work.
Yeah. So, you know, again, coming from a small town, I didn't know what graduate school entailed. And when I went on my interview at Syracuse, they told me that, you know, you come here, we will pay your tuition for graduate school, and we'll pay you a stipend that you can live off of. They were the first people to tell me that, and so that's where I went. I had no idea that that was common of every graduate school and every graduate program, so I may have ended up somewhere else if someone else had told me that first.
Now, if you put things in motion, this is advice from Health Matters. If you put things in motion, good things tend to happen. If you have a plan, you may not finish the plan that you have, but in some cases, a better plan comes along. So, again, Matt put himself out there. He had strong grades after the Blues Festival incident and was able to get into Syracuse. And there, life lesson number two you put is read the literature and identify your rock. Explain to me what you mean by identify your rock.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you have to find out sort of where your the center is in your life. And so there's science and whatever whatever profession you choose is you're going to have some tough times. In science, there's a lot of failure. Probably 75% of the experiments you do are going to fail early on. You have to figure out what in life it is that you can lean on, if that's a spouse, if that's a significant other, if that's a religious aspect, parents, and really draw some inspiration from them as you move through this process.
And so you did move through the process. You you were able to join a laboratory there as a graduate student at Syracuse, working on my understanding is some cell signaling, how cells communicated with each other. Take me through your graduate work and how you then became interested in Lafora disease.
So it's really did some basic cancer research using a model organism of yeast to figure out how cells divide. And we could apply that, what we learned in yeast, to human cell division. And so, you know, as you move through the graduate program, your sort of currency of what matters in your life changes. You know, when you start out as an undergraduate, your currency are your grades or your score, your GRE scores or your MCAT scores. As you become a graduate student, that currency is the papers that you publish or the grants that you obtain as a graduate student. You have to learn how to tell a story about the science that you do and communicate that science. So in graduate school, I had a very good mentor that taught me how to do experiments, how to be critical of the data that I got, and then how to write those experiments up into papers. And that becomes the currency then to move on to your next phase of training, which in my field is a postdoctoral fellowship.
Now, again, for our radio fans who are looking at the possibility of a career in science, that shift is really critical. It's not like in graduate school you simply take harder classes. At some point, you have to be producing science, I guess, rather than consuming science, and you seem to learn that lesson well. As a matter of fact, your life lesson three, work hard at the bench and stay afraid without letting your fear disable you. Now, talk to me about staying afraid.
Yeah, you know, fear can either you get that deer in the headlight look where you just freeze and you do nothing. And I've seen colleagues during graduate school do that. They're afraid of an experiment that it might fail, and so they don't do anything. Or you can let that fear motivate you. You can work harder to try to figure out that problem. And I think that's what I tell my students all the time is that to let that fear motivate them to get more work done and answer the questions at hand.
Postdoctorate at San Diego?
Yeah. So the work at San Diego, it was a big shift. Syracuse is a medium-level research institute. San Diego is a top 10. And so the speed of science was a lot faster at San Diego. The expectations were higher. But the resources were unlimited, and the surrounding colleagues were just amazing. It was a fantastic time to do science there in San Diego.
And life lesson number four, be scientifically savvy and social at meetings. That is, figure out where you need to make connections is what I'm getting from
that. Yeah, you don't just go to the meeting and hear the science. Before the meeting, you look at who's going to be speaking at that meeting and do some background work to know what questions you want to ask those people to figure out how you can better yourself.
But the second part of that sentence, also have good data. We're going to talk more about data in our second fractional portion, but we're going to take a break first and let you recover. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Matthew Gentry Show because we have, from the University of Kentucky, professor in the Department of Molecular and Cellular Biochemistry. Take that, Rick.
Don't kid yourself. They edited out the two mistakes you made.
Director of UK's Brain Metabolism Program. Can't keep it going. Yes, I can act like a radio celebrity for
18 10, seconds.
Yeah, something like that, but that's it. And director of the LaFora Epilepsy
Don't
Cure
be scared,
Initiative
Tony.
Center.
Don't,
thank
don't
you
have
very
fear.
Much. I'm trying to do that. It's Dr. Matthew Gentry. Welcome back, man.
Thanks, Tony.
Our sponsor for the second time, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease is LaFora disease. Remember their motto, it's a rare disease, but don't ignore a serious condition like LaFora. Top eight facts about LaFora disease. LaFora fact number one, it's inherited. It's a severe form of progressive epilepsy that also is accompanied by dementia. That is, there is actual brain damage with LaFora disease. LaFora fact number two, most cases caused by a autosomal recessive mutation in a couple of genes. Again, that means that you can be a carrier and have nothing wrong, but if two carriers have a baby, there's a 1 in 4 chance that they will have this disease. LaFora fact number three, mutations interfere with the production of proteins which forms LaFora bodies, and we'll talk more about that later this segment. Fact number four, affected people experience rapid cognitive deterioration beginning about the same time as seizures, which begin in adolescence. It's often fatal within 10 years of onset. You're looking at people who are doomed to die in their mid-20s. Fact number five, I guess fortunately, you could say that there are only 200 reported cases. Exact prevalence is unknown. Most patients have ancestry from Mediterranean, Middle East, and India. Fact number six, symptoms appear during late childhood or adolescence. We talked about that. The most common symptom is recurrent seizures, which become worse and more difficult to treat over time. And then we'll stop here with fact number seven. With the onset of these seizures, people start showing cognitive decline. By mid-20s, most people lose the ability to perform activities of daily living. They have continuous muscle spasms, and they require comprehensive care. I'll say at this fractional portion, if you were Satan himself and were designing a disease to plague mankind, LaFora disease would be a reasonable first effort.
It's a devastating disease. I've met a few parents who they have a child. The child gets diagnosed around age 18. They already have two more children, and they find out that both of those children have it as well. And so those younger siblings can see what their life's going to progress like in their older brother or sister.
So we'll get to that in a moment. I want everybody to understand Matt as a scientist and a researcher, and then we'll move forward to the disease that he is currently researching. Now, let's go back and review our last fractional portion. Growing up, Southern Indiana, went to University of Evansville, thought about physical therapy. That did not work out. From that failure, success in biochemistry and science. He went to Syracuse for graduate work, went to San Diego for a postdoc, and we talked about his life lesson number four, be savvy, understand who are the leaders in the field that you're studying, make sure that you make those social connections, but you got to have data, you got to do the work. Just knowing people, you've heard it's not what you know, it's who you know. Well, I think it's both.
Only takes you so far.
Yeah.
The scientists want to see data. That's what we live and breathe. And so at the end of the day, you have to have good results and understand those results.
So talk to me about your experience in San Diego. Yeah, you mentioned the science was fast, but at that point you started focusing really on this disease.
We did, yeah. We came into San Diego and some gene hunters up in Toronto and Los Angeles had identified two genes that were mutated or faulty in LaFora's disease patients. So they had the genes, but they didn't know what those genes did. And so being a biochemist, I want to know, what do proteins do? Proteins are sort of the engines of the cell. They do the work in the cell. They make things happen. And so we wanted to know what's wrong with these engines in LaFora's disease that gives these patients the disease.
Now, so you're working on this. You know the genes. You're trying to figure out what they do. Life lesson number five, read the literature, even the old stuff.
Yeah, so you know, this not everything's online. Some stuff is still
online. Bite your tongue. Just bite your tongue. Yeah.
So sorry, Rick. You can leave now. You might want to go to the Blues Festival in Memphis, Rick, because he is absolutely right.
There's some stuff that's still in the library, and
I bet you watch black and white movies, don't you?
Yeah.
So how did that help you?
Well, so we were stuck. We had come to a dead end on trying to figure this out. A lot is known about glycogen metabolism. There were a number of Nobel Prizes given for work on glycogen metabolism a decade, 100 years ago even. And so we thought we knew everything about how the body stores carbohydrates and sugar metabolism.
Some of us better than others.
Yeah. But okay, but Rick, that's a good point. So glycogen then, your body takes in sugar and these carbohydrates, and it has to have a way to process them and store them. And glycogen is basically aggregated sugar and carbohydrates.
Exactly. It's the storage molecule that we use. And so we thought we knew that process, but we couldn't figure out what these Lafora disease proteins were doing. And we started looking then at how plants, how they deal with carbohydrates and sugars. And that was some really old work that brought these two fields together and was kind of a eureka moment in breaking the mystery of what was going on in the disease.
Now, you know, I'm not a genius, but I have some ideas about what genius people do.
Are you looking for confirmation?
No. There is no sympathy anywhere in the studio right now.
You want me to be supportive of you on this endeavor?
But I want you to realize when you take information from one area and apply it to a different area, it is, in my mind, one of the marks of genius. Keep in mind, dead end. And when we say dead end, it's not like, well, you're having a bad afternoon.
Correct.
This was
a couple of years.
Of trying and not succeeding at figuring out why people get Lafora disease.
So how many years have we been doing health matters? Are we all like 15?
It's time for a moment of genius, isn't it, Rick?
Let's try something different.
I'm going to go see what kind of plant radio shows there are out there. We'll see. But to change then, to move away from human physiology to find the answer, Matt, I told you you have my utmost admiration. To make that kind of leap, when you say eureka moment, I want people to realize 2 years trying, failing, going back, leaving the human physiology and going back to the plants and saying, all right, let's find a new model for what happens with this glycogen. A remarkable thing. Which led to lesson number 6, learn to be a good salesman.
Yeah, once you have a story, you've got to be able to explain that to your peers and to the scientific community as well as the public. And so my advisor in San Diego, Jack Dixon, was excellent at this and taught us how to write about science, how to talk about science, and really communicate that to all levels of an audience.
And that is frustrating. Being able to communicate science is a rare talent. And I assume then you made this breakthrough. You realized that now how did you then apply that back to the disease? You figured out plants do something different with glycogen. Run me through that and explain to me how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, so the plants, the enzymes in the plants people were just starting to figure out how they break down an insoluble carbohydrate. And so that's very similar to what Lafora disease patients have. Tony, you and I and Rick as well, we all have our carbohydrates are water soluble. They can be dissolved sort of in water. But plants, they have a water insoluble carbohydrate, which is exactly what we see with Lafora disease patients. So when we figured out that plants have enzymes to deal with this problem, we started thinking about that in the disease scenario as well. And that was really the breakthrough moment that let us figure out what these proteins are doing.
Right. Soluble, insoluble. Think crackers, mm-hmm. which dissolve in your mouth, versus, say, the communion wafers, which are made out of styrofoam or
there
something. And, yeah. And don't dissolve.
They had a half-life of 50,000 years.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can actually... I'm sorry. So we're going down. Let's turn around and get back to the radio show. But the point is then we have these soluble things, the crackers, the things that dissolve in your saliva. And so, these things are halfway gone before they even get to your stomach, whereas the plants, they have a different process. And that's where you got your inspiration.
Exactly.
And so tell me then how that applied to Lafora disease.
Yeah, so with Lafora's disease, the mutations in the genes that cause the disease, what they do is they modify this soluble glycogen. And if that soluble glycogen is not modified appropriately at a biochemical level, then it starts to clump together. It starts to clump together and form these Lafora bodies. And these Lafora bodies then start to kill neurons. So what we see in these patients is that while the Lafora bodies form in all cell types, the only cells that undergo dramatic problems are neurons. And so the disease is really focused on the neuronal aspect of the issues. the epilepsy, the neurodegeneration, and then eventually the death. And we think that that's all caused by these Lafora bodies.
Again, you've got the genes. The genes are controlling the proteins. You've got an abnormal gene, or two abnormal genes together in a person with Lafora disease. They create a protein that doesn't work. That turns a cracker into a communion wafer. All of a sudden, your cells can't handle that communion wafer, and it builds up. Something happens, especially to the nerve cells. They deteriorate, and the seizures come out.
There you go.
Okay. Most of my knowledge of things is comic book. I've just got a nice comic book understanding of Lafora disease. Thanks for that, Matt. And then life lesson number 7, take advantage of as many opportunities and open as many doors as possible. Once you made that breakthrough, you got grant funding, and you were able to walk me through this. The second thing that is very impressive is you got the attention of a lot of people around the world with this project.
Yeah, when you know it's difficult to cure a disease, right? No matter what disease you're talking about, and in this Lafora disease scenario here, we now have a disease that we know the genes that are faulty, we know the proteins and what those proteins are doing, and so that gives us the opportunity to attack the disease and come up with a cure. And so, about 5 years ago, those of us in the Lafora disease community started coming together and thinking about this idea of a cure, and it's becoming a reality.
You were able to sell this, and once you figured these things out, you have both the community of people who have the disease and the research community pursuing this line of research.
We do, yeah. There's a very strong patient advocacy group for this disease. It's called Chelsea's Hope. This was named after a young woman who died of the disease in her mid-20s. Her mother, Linda Gerber, founded the foundation. And they have been in existence for about a decade now. And their main goal is to not exist anymore. They want a cure for the disease so that they don't have to be around. And, you know, they are able to raise funds. But as you said, this is a rare disease, so there's not a lot of folks that suffer from it. There's not a lot of money coming in for this disease. And what they decided to do to use their money was to bring together the dozen or so labs that work on this disease into one house in a meeting and start to come up with ideas of how to attack the disease and come up with a cure.
And my understanding was part of the fuel for trying to get funding came from those families.
It did, yeah. So we had a meeting back in 2014, and I suggested to the group that we could write for a collaborative grant rather than competing against each other for grant funding, go for a collaborative grant, and we put that into the National Institutes of Health. Wasn't successful the first time, but the second time we got a $9.5 million grant over the next 5 years to work on this disease and translate really three main areas from the scientific bench to the bedside and come up with a cure for the disease.
$9.5 million. Lafora disease affects less than 1 in a million people.
Correct.
Now, it's a terrible disease. I'm reading this from the International Journal for Life Science Method. Few conditions more heartbreaking than Lafora disease. We've known about it since the early 1900s. The symptoms emerge, as we mentioned, in apparently healthy teenagers, presents as epilepsy, beginning with seizures and convulsions. It soon progresses to visual hallucinations where monsters and horrifying visions invade their thoughts. The seizure drugs keep some symptoms at bay initially, but they quickly fail. Seizures increase in frequency. Hallucinations grow stronger. Dementia develops. No treatment or cure. Death within 5 to 10 years of diagnosis. An absolutely hideous disease. But wait a minute. You know, it's a rare disease, less than 1 in a million. So we're spending all this money for this rare disease. Talk to us about why, and with no disservice to the people that have it, but why do we spend that much money? We could save more lives if we treated common conditions.
Definitely, yeah, very valid question. Really, really a twofold answer to that. So, you know, one is that studying these rare diseases give us unique windows to look at how brain metabolism functions and then what goes wrong when there is a mutation in genes affecting brain metabolism. So it gives us some academic insights into what's going on. But really more importantly is that the hope is that we can translate what we find in Lafora's disease to to more common diseases. And really for this case, there's two classes of diseases that we hope to translate our work into. One are there's a whole class of glycogen storage diseases. These are diseases that turn that cracker into a communion wafer, 12 different types, maybe 13 types. And we can potentially, the treatments we have for Lafora disease can be used for that disease. And secondarily, Lafora disease is an epilepsy. And so we're now starting to think of can epilepsies be thought of as a metabolic disorder rather than sort of the classical thought of what they are.
See, Tony, I would have said that the same exact question evolves around why do we go to space?
Yeah, I understand.
It's about the exploration.
It is about exploration and knowledge. But I'll come back to what you do, Rick. If you have a model where there's something wrong, and you figure out why that something is wrong, then that is going to help you next time, whether it's a computer or whether it's a human being.
Well, I usually just don't let you use it. And that fixes so many things.
Oh, and let me tell you, wouldn't it be lovely to reboot a human being? I mean, you just basically just hit the reboot, and then the guy goes back, and we start all over again.
I don't know if that sounds good or not.
just throwing it out
But there is something about the process. I mean, you know, I'm not obviously not deep in you know biochemistry or anything, but from a pure science on the electrical side, on the mechanical and on the device side, we do things for exploration. We do things to further our knowledge, and there's always abilities to translate solutions from one problem to create solutions for another problem. Right. And we look at it, you know, today, how many people walk around with oxygen concentrators? Well, the first oxygen concentrator was developed so they could keep people on oxygen in space. So really, I mean, you look at it and you just go, okay, you know, it's the same thing. Why do we have super glue? You know, because somebody had to create a way to close a wound for a military, for an infantryman. So there's so many reasons to do things that transform into other reasons. And so I totally get it. And
you're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Matthew Gentry Show.
Why do we do that?
You know, you're just the best co-host ever. I got to tell you that. You won't even let me get out the name of the show before you start segueing. That's too much segue, Rick. You know, I like segues.
You don't even know what a segue is. That's something you ride around on campus,
isn't it? Segueing too much. From the University of Kentucky, a professor in the Department of Molecular and Cellular Biochemistry. Take that.
Hey, you got it right once.
Director of UK's Brain Metabolism Program, director of Lafora Epilepsy Cure Initiative Center, Dr. Matthew Gentry. Welcome back, Matt.
Thanks. Glad to be here, Tony.
Our sponsor for the final time, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease, Lafora disease. It's a rare disease, but don't ignore a serious condition like Lafora. Our top eight facts about Lafora disease. Lafora fact number one, it is an inherited severe form of progressive epilepsy. Most commonly begins with epileptic seizures in late childhood or adolescence. Lafora fact number two, most cases are caused by an autosomal recessive mutation. You have two genes that code for these proteins. Everybody does. If you have one of those genes that works properly, you're good. However, when a person with one bad gene meets another person with one bad gene and falls in love, then the chances their children will have Lafora disease are 1 in 4. All they got to do is get both bad genes in their genetic makeup, and they are in trouble. Lafora fact number three, mutations interfere with the production of proteins leading to the formation of Lafora bodies. And again, we'll talk more about that. This is what we talked about, the clumps of glycogen and the clumps of glucose that can't be broken down within the cells. And that is toxic, particularly to the nerve cells. Lafora fact number four, affected people experience a rapid cognitive deterioration beginning about the same time as seizures. It's often fatal within 10 years of onset. For fact number five, there's 200 reported cases in the scientific literature. The exact prevalence is unknown. Our numbers that we've looked at say about 1 in a million people affected. The symptoms of Lafora disease, fact number 6, appear late in childhood. We mentioned that, become worse and more difficult to treat. Lafora fact number 7, with the onset of seizures, the cognitive decline starts. By the mid-20s, they lose the ability to perform activities of daily living and care for themselves. Lafora fact number 8, affected people survive around 10 years after the symptoms start. And as Matthew eloquently mentioned, if this runs in families, other members of the family can see their future in the person there. So that's a little bit about Lafora disease. That's our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club. Now, when we left last time, we had sort of gone through how Matt, first of all, his educational pathways to becoming a world-class researcher, the breakthroughs that he made, which I think there were two things here that are really unique. We get to talk about a lot of research on this program, but the idea of leaving human research and human physiology for a moment and studying plants to try to figure out why these clumps occurred, what the function of the proteins were, because plants are faced with a problem similar to Lafora patients. And so he asked, what does a plant do that these victims can't do? And that was a major breakthrough when he realized the functions that had to be done by these proteins. And then the final thing was in building the network. And Matt, talk a little bit about that. You got this grant, a $9 million grant. They said, all right, we're going to spread this out among institutions. How did you guys get together on this, and how do you divide up the work on a problem like this?
Yeah, so the way we got together was really through that patient advocacy group, Chelsea's Hope, that brought us together and allowed us the time and space over about a 3-day period to talk about where the research was and where we needed to go. And so that was very integral. In terms of figuring out who should do what, I think it comes back to this idea of you have to do what you're best at. And so we looked at, you know, there's a couple of groups in Spain. There was a group in Canada, a group at UCLA, a group at Indiana University, and then myself here at University of Kentucky, along with a couple other professors, Dave Watt in the biochemistry department, as well as Craig Vanderkoy. And we just looked to see who's the best at doing each of the aspects that needed to be done, and those folks took on those responsibilities. And so, that part's not rocket science or brain surgery. It's do what you're good at and let those people do what they're good at.
Was there contentiousness with that?
There was. You know, there's in science, like in any profession, there's a little bit of ego at play. There's a little bit of some people want all of the marbles, right? They want all the toys. And you have to just kind of stand up to them and say that, look, we can't do it that way. And the other thing that really helped was we had parents of these patients in the room. And so at one point, one of the dads stands up and said, look, I'm going to play the dad card here and tell you guys to figure this out and work together and get this done. And that was really a turning point in the workshop.
You know, it is interesting. You tend to think of science as being done, again, in a laboratory. Maybe there's something bubbling over in the corners, a couple of computers up and so forth. But the idea of the patient's family watching, and I know they don't come into the lab every day, but when you have these meetings and you're trying to work out strategy, having the parents of kids with this condition overseeing it.
It sounds kind of stressful.
It does. I don't think it sort of inhibits the comedy at the time, and you take things seriously. I think the other thing is you get some sense of urgency from them, I would imagine.
You do, and motivation. And what we try to do in these workshops, we've had 3 of them now, 2 in San Diego and 1 in Barcelona for our Spanish collaborators. And we always make sure that we bring in the trainees. We bring in the next generation, the graduate students and the postdocs, so that they can see that as well and get that motivation, because they're the ones that are going to be back at the bench doing the work to make these seminal discoveries.
Then the final thing, we talked about Lafora bodies. I want to make sure people understand, and I'll give you again, the comic book version. My comic book version is the way sugar is supposed to work is it's supposed to be, as you said, water soluble, so it sort of melts away. Your body can assemble it into a storage form, and then it can basically break that storage form down as it needs it. What's a Lafora body, and how does this affect the cells and the nerve cells? How does this work? I mean, it's a lump. It just sits there, right?
Correct, yeah. So what happens is that there's a modification that occurs on the glycogen, the carbohydrate naturally. But there can only be so much of that modification, and it's called phosphorylation. And so the protein in Lafora disease that gets mutated, it's supposed to take some of that phosphorylation off. And if it doesn't take enough of it off, you get too much phosphorylation, and then those glycogen molecules start to clump together into large balls. And then those large accumulations of water, now insoluble glycogen, what they do is they start to starve the cell of energy, number one. And number two, there becomes trafficking issues. If you can think about a large cement block in the middle of the road, you can no longer move things through there that need to get through. And so the parts of the cell start to starve because they can't get the cargo that they need to move through the cell because of that Lafora body.
So that's what we know, what Matt knows and what I've learned by reading some of Matt's work. About Lafora disease. We talked about this as a rare disease, but as a possible window into figuring out other problems with the way glucose is stored. There are some other diseases. None of them are terribly common, but more common than this. And then secondly, the big picture here is if we rethink the way we think of epilepsy and seizures as a condition of metabolism, and again, figuring out why this causes seizures is going to be a big part of that, then that makes sense. Now, we've got a little bit of time left, Matt, and I know you're sitting right now. The thing that bothers you, the thing that drives you, is trying to find a cure for this disease. You do not have to, on a day-to-day basis, wonder if you're going to run out of money because you have created this network and people are collaborating and the research is being funded. But talk to us a little bit about what we need to know about science research and science research funding.
Yeah, so the major funding institutes for science research are in biomedical research are the National Institutes of Health, NIH, or the National Science Foundation, or the NSF. And, you know, as a scientist, we spend a lot of time trying to get money from those agencies. We come up with ideas. We send those ideas to the agencies. A panel of scientists review those ideas, and then only about 15% of those ideas get funded and allow you to work on that. And, you know, in the heyday of science, sort of back in the late 70s and 80s, about 40% of the scientific ideas were funded. But the country stopped funding as much science through the 90s, and that funding rate started to go down. So really starting with the first President Bush and going through the Clinton years and then George W. Bush, we doubled the scientific budget for the National Institutes of Health twice. The scientific budget went from about $7 billion up to about $27 billion. That was for the NIH budget. But then over the last from about 2010 to 2015, we've had no increases. And because of inflationary pressures, we've lost about 20% of our purchasing power. And so that then means that fewer ideas are being funded. And so right now, only about 15% of grants get funded. And so as a scientist, it gets frustrating that you spend time writing grants and not doing the science.
Now, we looking at the timing of that, then 2010, we were ramping up the Affordable Care Act. This was during the Obama administration. The money, I don't suppose there's anyone just pulled it out of one account and put it in another, but we were focusing on providing insurance and clinical care, and the research part was neglected. Now, and I know when people talk about research, you will hear someone in the legislature hold up a paper published on asphalt and the problems with tennis shoes or something like that. And I want you to realize for every study that seems frivolous, you have people that are desperately working to save human lives from these diseases and perhaps expand our knowledge and our ability to care for other diseases. So this is not you can always pick out those examples. I would not want my life to be combed over and look for stupid things I'd done because I have done a number of stupid things.
Very publicly, I might add.
Some of them with Rick. And so we have that collective legacy. But I want you to realize that for every smart for every stupid thing, there are smart people like Matthew Gentry who are working to save human lives.
And even some of those what we think of stupid at the time, you mentioned CRISPR. CRISPR came about by looking at bacteria that make our yogurt and our cheeses, and basic scientists looking at some of the processes involved in that. So at the time, no one would have realized that this could have been developed into a major biomedical tool. So really, you know, as a biochemist, we would want to promote that you don't know where the major discoveries are going to come from, and you have to let the science go where it leads you, and then we can apply that to the biomedical community.
As a matter of fact, I'd heard that stated as the major difference between science in the United States after World War II and science in the former Soviet Union, was that we allowed scientists to follow where the information led, whereas they tried to direct their science into useful categories, and that, in fact, that system collapsed. Now, the question is, you know, obviously, what's going to happen to our system without that infusion? It's almost like we have no choice but to direct it into useful stuff because there's no money. And then these type of things that really lead to widespread changes in scientific thinking go unfunded. The other thing I saw in your literature is that the age when a person – you think of these grants. Okay, these grants are the things that really start a scientist in his or her career. The age where you get your first grant now –
dramatically increased. It's gone up to almost 44, 45 years old before the first researcher gets their first grant. And so that's, you know, you think of when you're the most creative in your career. Congress has put in new laws to try to get that age down, and the National Institutes of Health is working to decrease that number.
85% of ideas go unfunded. Only 15% get a grant. Those 15% tend to be from people with an established reputation. Young scientists, new scientists face an uphill battle getting funding. Without funding.
And I would assume they become parts of teams of people that do get funded. I would assume that's how the growth process, or is that correct?
That's one avenue to go down, yes.
Yeah. How old were you when you started, when you finished your postdoc?
When I came to UK, I was 36 and got my first grant at 38.
Now imagine, if you would, a man of this capability, a person who is on the way to, we believe, I'm going to be optimistic about this, on the way to curing a rare disease. Let's just delay the start of his career for a decade.
Right. Devastating.
It really is. I mean, it's personally devastating. It's very hard to create a career when you really don't see the possibility of funding until you're in your 40s. And it also, as you said, these young people in our country, these brilliant young scientists, unfortunately, it's discouraging. And I know for Health Matters Radio fans, my daughter, as we are recording the show, is looking at positions. She is an MD, PhD, looking for positions for residency and postdoctoral work, and is very discouraged. She knows that the funding is going to be very difficult, and she may not have that opportunity that Matt and other scientists of previous generations have had. So I take it personally, but also I grieve for patients who are denied the fruits of these brilliant young researchers who have to wait this long for funding. I mean, it's hard all over. That's the argument. Well, we gotta buy food for people. We've gotta treat the conditions we know how to treat. We can't do this frivolous stuff. And yet the scientific progress is at a standstill. If you are similar to the Lafora disease, you are starving the science of the fuel they need to do their research.
Matty does this all the time. He brings everybody on a downer trip. that's his role.
Listen, if you're a health show, things very rarely end well.
Well, that's not true. What kind of a thing is that?
I'm just saying how you think about it. I mean, diseases. How many do we cure?
It's like you're saying we're all going to die.
Okay. He set me up. I'm going to just let the audience think about that, because that, in fact, is the problem with the health show, isn't it? I mean, we're all going to die. Some of us more spectacularly than others, and the higher you're stupid.
And if we made fun of you, we're sorry. Well, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. But the higher your stupid quotient, the more spectacular your eventual demise is. And so Rick and I, we plan on being, if nothing else, entertaining.
Have you ever seen fireworks? Similar.
No metabolic condition is going to do us in, by golly. We take matters into our own hands. Matt, again, I just
incredible work.
Good job. It really is. I want to thank. By the way, before we go, I'm sorry, Rick. I know I'm going to run over, but let me ask you: the UK Brain Metabolism Program, aside from Lafora disease, what's the Brain Metabolism Program doing?
So we're just getting off and running, and the goal of that program is to bring together basic scientists and clinicians that work on a number of different diseases with the idea that problems with metabolism could be at the heart of more common diseases that we think of, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, and even stroke.
I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Matthew Gentry.
Special thanks to WUKY producer John Lamagi and our Morehead State Public Radio producer Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show, and remember,
few radio shows are more heartbreaking than Health Matters. Symptoms of Health Matters emerge during adolescence in apparently healthy teenagers, often presenting as epilepsy.
Unfortunately, there is no treatment or cure for Health Matters, and death generally occurs within 5 to 10 years of listening.
Health Matters is defined as a rare orphan radio show. The rarity of Health Matters presents unique challenges for the small community of researchers dedicated to eradicating it. Basic research funding is available, but when it comes to developing treatments, money becomes rare.
If you haven't heard Health Matters before, that's not surprising. The show is exceedingly rare, being heard by less than 1 in 1 million people. This means that at any moment, there will only be a few hundred people listening to Health Matters in the United States.
Boy, ain't that the truth. Scientists from around the globe who were once competitors will now work together in the hope of bringing Health Matters to an end. Perhaps as importantly, this small community working on one of the rarest of radio shows now has a unique challenge to demonstrate how strong basic research discoveries and effective community interaction can be translated into good outcome.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change, and tune in next week for more ridiculous information from medical science and research on Morehead State Public Radio.